BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Monday is the 4th of July, US Independence Day, but some American bases in the UK, local people are celebrating Independence from America Day. Well, in some ways, like the Afghans and Iraqis, the US presence gets on their nerves and they're fed up with fenced-off sections of Britain being treated as Americans' unsinkable aircraft carrier. And we hear from a Swiss author whose book, NATO's Secret Armies, documents at last NATO's top secret programme. It's called Operation Gladio, and lots of innocent civilians died, including police. But it was all blamed on the Russians. Plus, the concluding extract from Keith Allen's banned film Unlawful Killing about the assassination of Princess Diana, which is being watched everywhere in the world except it's banned in Britain. First, though, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, the government elected by the British people has been closely involved in instigating many of the military conflicts in the world today. British powers being projected to the far sides of the globe, as if we still had an empire and an economy to back it up. Heads of the armed services this week have spoken out, and the last few weeks anyway, making it clear that our forces are stretched too far. Could Libya be a war too far? Although the television brings these conflicts into our living rooms, how much does it really show us of the thoughts and feelings of those putting their lives at risk for us, the soldiers? Well, I'm joined now by a former soldier, is Elijah James Smith. Hello, Elijah, and welcome to Drive Time.
Evening, Tony. How are you?
Very well. Now, first of all, why did you join the army?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. You stumped me on the first question.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a difficult one. I'd done it because at that age I wasn't thinking. Most gentlemen.
How old were you?
I think I was about 19 the first time I joined. Well, the British Army, at least, anyway. I joined with the French in 86, so before, but I didn't last very long with them.
Okay, so you were sort of just, you weren't really sure why.
No, I was just bored.
And how long did you actually stay in?
I was a soldier for 16 years. I worked privately with the French, Portuguese. That was a bit humorous.
Okay,
and ultimately... And the British, obviously.
Yeah. Why did you leave, ultimately?
I went a little bit cuckoo. And I actually looked at what I was doing and I was like, oh dear, this is a very bad reality, I don't want it anymore.
Okay, and because there is this sense of camaraderie that many feel in the army, I mean, surely you're actually, it's almost like a end of a marriage, isn't it? Breaking away from that camaraderie, your friends, your close friends.
You can have the same camaraderie with any human. It's a human element, it's not a military thing, camaraderie. People who think that it's only restrained to institutions like the military have a lot to think about.
And what about your training? I mean, was it what you were expecting as a young sort of 20-year-old? Was it pretty harsh, or how did it go?
It was difficult, but challenge is a good thing for a young man.
What are your thoughts about the whole thing of national service? Do you think it's actually a good idea to have people go through this for a year? And is it something that you think will actually benefit others?
No, I think it's a complete infringement of people's civic rights. You can't tell somebody that they have to do something in some role, I mean. And it's unnecessary. We already have a military force that's way outsizes our needs. All we need is defence on our own shores. We don't need to be interfering with anybody else. Having our kids come back with no legs and stuff, it's ridiculous.
So I take it you're against some of the conflicts that are going on now, but can you tell us where you first saw action after you were trained?
I first saw action in Sierra Leone, briefly, and then Bosnia was very impressionable, and then I went straight on from Bosnia, from Croatia, stuck in Bihać for a couple of months, and I was there in April when Habyar Amana's jet landed in his garden and Rwanda kicked off for 2 months. After that, I stayed out of it for quite a while, just doing private work, driving and stuff like that. Not all soldiering is Rambo. A lot of it's just driving people around. rather ironically, people from aid agencies who really don't like you. So it's not a comfortable.
I was one of those.
Well, I was just going to say, Miles,
you know exactly what it's like then. So it's a very uncomfortable, tense situation.
I thought the British Army did quite a good job in Bosnia. Frankly, I was quite impressed. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of the other things that they've done, but I think that's the sort of thing they ought to be doing rather than charging around invading places.
I mean, did you feel when you were over there, Elijah, that you actually were doing something really useful? Did you feel that you were making a contribution?
Yeah, I did, yeah, that time I did.
Okay, and so, I mean, it seems to me that there's a situation where sometimes you're posted to something where you feel actually it's worthwhile doing it and you can feel proud of what you're doing, and possibly other times not. Can you tell us some of your, maybe Martin, if you could just talk about the situation as it was in Bosnia, in former Yugoslavia, the previous president Tito had gone, and suddenly things started falling apart slowly but surely.
There's obviously a ferociously long backstory there, and it was very, very complicated. I mean, I'm a political analyst, and it was the most complicated thing I've ever looked at. And the closer you got to it, the more complicated it was. You will know that there were factions within factions in each of the different groups.
The
Hoss people and the Croatians, I went through Croatia just after it was ethnically cleansed by the Croatians. You know, it was just empty.
I fought with the 17th, the Knights of Vitezda Krajina, Vitezda Great Krajina.
I mean, what the British Army were doing there basically was behaving a bit like referees almost in the middle of the situation.
And the fact that
a very useful role. And frankly, when we had to go to briefings by the army about where to go and what not to do, you know, I sat and listened because you're going to get killed if you don't listen.
New map every day. So.
Yes, new map every day. And of course, it was very complicated. We used to drive down these little roads, and you never know what is around the corner. No. In fact, I got back from Bosnia to find on my desk a thing saying, "Whatever you do, don't go to Tuzla because there's an Iranian Mujahideen faction that wants to kidnap a British aid worker." And I'd actually strap-hanged with the guys on the bus going into Tuzla, the guys that were supposedly going to kidnap a British aid worker. Mm-hmm. And I got back to find that I shouldn't have been there at all, but actual fact, nothing happened. But it was messy because it was just such a messy war, wasn't it? There was no real front line except just appearing around the corner you're on it.
The most ironic thing is due to COVID, people had to go to the Croats to get their supplies to fight the Serbs. Mm. The Croats were getting their stuff from the Serbs, so it's a circular war.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a lot of bad things going on by bad people. I was one of the first people into Mostar. In fact, the first aid worker into Mostar after it had been under siege for 18 months. And I was shocked, horrified, nasty. And, of course, I went back to the other side to talk to the Croats, and their response was, "They started it." I thought, oh, God. And, of course, they were all eating properly, you know, and just staring down at these people. And, of course, the Croats were just as bad as the Serbs, really. And the poor old Bosnians were just being mashed around by everybody, weren't they? And, of course, they then reacted to that by behaving badly, because people do. There's no good sides in a war, is there? It's all people killing people.
It's not a good reality.
No.
And it wasn't helped by the Vance Owen thing, level killing fields and stuff like that. How do we create a level killing field?
The whole problem began at the beginning when they recognised Slovenia and Croatia, because the Germans were pushing for that.
Yeah.
And of course that then left everybody else in the lurch. I saw the TV programme where the Bosnians are sitting there thinking, oh God, we don't want independence, we want to be part of Yugoslavia, because it was always going to be a mess for them, because it was all mixed population. And the Western powers, I spoke to a guy who's a Bulgarian foreign minister in Sofia, and I said, "They've made a right mess of this, haven't they?" And he said, "They did it deliberately." And I didn't believe it at the time. I thought, he said, "They've done it deliberately." And looking back on it now, the breakup of Yugoslavia was deliberately messed up. The Americans have now got a massive base in Kosovo, Camp Bondsteel.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, and it's a major drugs transshipment point. Yeah. Mm. And they've got the people in charge really are gangsters, our people.
We know that, though, don't we?
Yeah. Well, you know it, and I know it, but a lot of people out there don't know it.
But that's a bit of a shocking thing to say. I mean, we've heard this kind of thing from Martin before. The people in charge on our side are gangsters?
Oh, come on, wake up, sir.
But I mean, surely that's a bit of a controversial thing to say. Most people would think that when we're getting involved in a conflict like that, we're simply going in there as peacekeepers. I mean, surely there are some decent people and some gangsters. It's not all gangsterism, surely.
The world is run by gangsters. It's a simple, plain fact. Every time you say something like that, everyone says, "Oh, conspiracy theorist. Get this for a conspiracy."
Stuff.
You have people who form themselves into gangs, and then they use violence to get what they wish for, mostly the resources, the water, the food and the oil. It's all quite blatant to see. There is no question about it. It's just boring to keep saying it because it's all been said before, but that is a fact.
Okay, what about after the Yugoslavian conflict and after you've been in Africa, were you involved in any of these more modern conflicts like Iraq, Afghanistan, this kind of thing?
No.
And at what point in your career in the army, 16 years is a long time to spend in the army, at what point did you start thinking, well, actually, you know, this isn't for me? Was it just because you were getting older and you thought, you know, that wasn't what you wanted to do? I mean, you were saying that you felt you didn't like that reality, you wanted to change your reality, but was that a sudden process or a gradual process?
It's an obvious process. I had a breakdown of sorts. It's not a breakdown, in fact. I had a realisation, a moment of enlightenment that should have come 16 years earlier. It's just not nice. Stop it. It's not nice. There's other things you can do. We have an armed force. We have a lot of young knights who want to go charging about and doing this, that and the other. Well, why don't we put them into teams and send them into disaster areas where they'll be useful? And then they can get blown up a little bit there if they want. You know, it's not a problem. But when we look at the present situation, we have 85% civilian casualties. We have untrained children going out there being told they're heroes. And I'm not having it. You can't just say someone's a hero and then just wash it away and you can't say anything about it. That's not the case. It's not what's going on. It's child abuse. To take children as young as that and make them into people who've killed people with the residual side effects that follow.
I mean,
it's criminal.
Your name is Elijah. Has your faith actually... do you have a faith? And
no.
Has that actually affected your views at all?
I have a secular mind, so I'm sure there's some scientific explanation for why we're here. That's my viewpoint. Everybody thinks Elijah, oh, look, another Jew. I mean, honestly, sir, my faith is not for debate.
Okay.
I haven't even worked it out myself.
Do you think your view about the sort of gangsterism of warfare, I mean, we have discussed this kind of thing on here before. I think it was Smedley Butler was talking about this, you know, sort of...
War is a racket,
this kind of thing. Do you think that's actually... I mean, this is not the sort of thing that we would normally hear about on the ITV news or in most of our mainstream media or in most of our newspapers. War is a racket, the army is there just to sort of bully around and a kind of extension of gangsterism. But is there actually, do you think, a consciousness of that in the forces generally, or is yours a lone voice?
Something I used to hear quite a lot, where people would remark, you know, when anything of contest came up, you know, why do these people protest this and the other? And there's a very honest view amongst what you'd call the boys, and it's that we're out to steal for our tribe. It's straight as that. We steal for our tribe, then you get a health service, you get good motorways, you get this, you get that. And it's justified by that. Politics is left for everybody else.
So, I mean, that sounds to me like a kind of a justification for the whole Iraq thing. I mean, do you think that's the mindset that was there in the beginning? Because we've heard many times that the actual intelligence was nonsense, that the policy had already been decided to attack Iraq, and the intelligence stuff, which was used to persuade the politicians and the public, was just fixed around that.
It's generally accepted, I think, that it was planned 2 years before or something like that. There's evidence to show that. But it's not a surprise, is it? There's no surprises in this. It's not a revelation. It's been going on forever. Imperialism, whatever you want to call it. When you start saying it's the forces of imperialism, it sounds a bit too rhetorical to me. But imperialism, to go and steal as much of the cargo as you can, as much of the land, it's been going on forever. We need a change of consciousness. It might be around the corner. But what does upset me a little bit is when we still have to talk about this when everybody knows the world is run by gangsters.
Well, I don't know if everybody believe that or know
it. Well, some people are just watching a bit too much EastEnders. I'm sure it's a good programme for a lot of people. But, you know, when you just watch stuff like that and here we are, you know, down the old Vic, roll out the barrel, it's 1950s London. Wake up, people. It's the 21st century.
But the trouble is, of course, you've been to many of these places and seen what goes on. for most of us, we just rely on our TVs in the living room showing us this stuff. And, of course, they don't necessarily show the reality. I mean, for example, at the beginning of the Iraq invasion, I can remember watching, I think it was Lunchtime News on ITV, which was live with one of the ITV reporters out somewhere in Iraq, just as it was all kicking off. And because it was live, one of the soldiers actually said, and one thing, don't believe a word you see on the television. Mm. But you see, they're very, very rarely would you actually see soldiers able to talk live on the television. Did you ever yourself see a kind of stuff which was talked about in the mainstream press that actually you'd been there and it wasn't quite like it said it was, or what? Is that something you've ever experienced?
When you look at the BBC, the ITV, Western Press as it is, they'll take a story, they'll draw out 3% of it, the most bland and banal, and then they'll just turn it into a non-story. I don't even watch the BBC or the ITV anymore because they don't say anything.
Martin, what are your thoughts about what we've been hearing from Elijah? Sounds to me as if there's a lot of cynicism, really, in the armed forces.
There is, but I mean, I would say that Sierra Leone and Bosnia were probably the good wars to have been in, rather than the really bad ones. You know, I think that there were some decent, worthwhile things
but
for the
these are quite a long time ago now. We're moving towards other types of wars. We're moving towards Afghanistan, and Libya.
Listen, the Chinese gave an ultimatum to the Americans after this so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden. An ultimatum is they've only had one since World War II. It's a serious, serious thing. If you do that again, going to Pakistan again, without getting their permission, you're not going to be taking on the Pakistanis, you're going to be taking on the Chinese People's Liberation Army. Now, we haven't heard this on the BBC. It's all over the world news, but not on the BBC. We've not been told that the Chinese have threatened to go to war with America. Now, that's how serious the situation is. The people running in China and people running Russia are gangsters, but they're rational gangsters. The people running the West are bonkers. They don't know when to stop, they don't know how to stop. And they're going to be stopped because, of course, the British and American armies are going to lose in Iraq and they're going to lose in Afghanistan. At the end of the day, if I was a young person in those countries, I would say, well, you know, sometimes you have to fight. And they are fighting. And they're winning. And they're going to win. That's going to be the end of it. The British army doesn't know what to do now. They can't go forward. They can't go back. The Taliban, they want to talk to the Taliban. The Taliban say, we don't want to talk to you. We're winning. Why should we talk to you? And that's the situation. And that ultimately is the only way bullies are ever dealt with. They're beaten, just like the Nazis.
So, Elijah, what are your thoughts about what Martin's saying? Do you think there's any real... I mean, you say there may be a change of consciousness, but then you've also saying it's always been like this.
So we need to try something else, sir.
Yeah. We can't afford another world war.
We can't.
I mean, do you think, because we've had some news, and I'll be talking about this in a minute, this just over the last week, about restructuring of the political way that the army's managed, etc., by Liam Fox, who's a local MP and now Defence Secretary. But do you think that there's any real possibility that we will be reined back from these foreign conflicts, such as Afghanistan, bringing all these troops back? I mean, we've had, for example, Kerry McCarthy on here, who's an MP. She's now... in the Treasury, for example, saying, well, we've got to be out in Afghanistan in order to protect Britain. I mean, whether or not you agree with that, it's a big decision-making system up there in Westminster to turn round, isn't it? To actually say, no, we're going to bring all those troops home.
I think the lady needs medical treatment, so...
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, we don't protect anything in the street where I live by patrolling in Afghanistan. It's nonsense. Well, in what way can you protect Britain by being in Afghanistan? The only thing we do is raise a lot of resentment there. And maybe one day, I mean, you always hear, don't you, these people, they're all suicide bombers and that. Well, where are they then, you know? We've been bombing them for years and years. Poor people, you know. They haven't got any way of defending themselves. We've bombed their infrastructure. We've messed their country up. And if they're so bad, if all these jihadis are so bad, where are they?
Well, most of them are actually run by Western intelligence services, as those who know. This is all a big game, isn't it? I mean, the reason they're in Afghanistan is basically to make pressure on the Chinese, and it's a big game. They're playing risk.
It's accepted, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, they're running out of road. basically the US military. I mean, the Chinese were invited to Bilderberg this year for the first time, and that's because they've realised that they've basically annoyed them and that they need to calm them down.
I think we should explain the Bilderberg conference is a very high level royalty.
Yeah, it's a big NATO shindig, isn't it?
Royalty are there, all the big banks, the IMF, the World Bank, the Federal Reserve, all the European Central Bank, all of the big oil corporations, etc., are in there. So the Chinese, you think they may be invited along to this high level political meeting because
they're threatened to go to war and they had to be calmed down.
It seems almost like there's a kind of shadow political
not
system
that anybody's telling us about
a shadow political system where actually what we're being shown on the TV with Kerry and all these people are actually kind of bit players in a much wider game.
Yeah. I mean, there's no popular support in this country for being in Afghanistan. When we've collected signatures to get British troops out of Afghanistan, all sections of the population have come over and signed. Nobody believes in it. And I don't believe the army believes in it. I don't believe the people who are out there believe in it. Nobody believes in it. But we're still doing it. But why? Because we're actually being used as pawns, you know. British army has now become America's Gurkhas.
Well, we'll be discussing Liam Fox, a local MP, and the changes he's brought about to the way that the defence in this country is managed over the last week after a bit of music from the 70s.
Uh-huh. War. Yeah. What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Say it again, y'all.
War.
Look out.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Listen to me.
Oh.
To me.
Whoa.
It ain't nothing but a heartbreak.
Whoa.
Friend only to the undertaker.
Oh.
To me.
Whoa.
It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker.
Whoa.
It's got one friend, that's the undertaker.
Oh.
Listen to me.
What?
It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker.
What?
Friend only to the undertaker.
Tell
me.
That's from the 1970s, Edwin Starr there. And War, What Is It Good For? I'm joined by Elijah Smith, who's a former soldier, did 16 years in the British Army, and by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, we were just discussing the sort of policing actions that that Britain was doing, Sierra Leone and Bosnia, peacekeeping Bosnia. We're in a very different state now, I think you both agree, with the invasion of Iraq, illegal occupation, illegal invasion of Iraq, I think it's fair to say, and in Afghanistan too, which was off the back of the 9/11 attacks, which are very questionable, to say the least. The latest conflict is in Libya, and I wonder, Martin, if you can just tell us your thoughts, because certainly at the beginning of the bombing of Libya and the UN resolution for a no-fly zone, you were actually quite enthusiastic, saying, well, actually, possibly, this is possibly going to be good for the Libyan people.
I wasn't ultimately enthusiastic, but, I mean, obviously, there was a no-fly zone over Bosnia. And that meant that the Serbs couldn't use their aircraft. I try to keep an open mind about things until I get the full facts. Now, we didn't know. I didn't know when I was saying, well, maybe this no-fly zone is legitimate. We didn't know, A, that they were going to use it as a kind of fig leaf to do whatever they wanted. Basically, they're just bombing the hell out of them, aren't they? And secondly, of course, I discovered this stuff on the French Air Force website, Operation Southern Mistral 2011. People can look it up. The whole war was planned in advance by the French and the British. So the idea that there was also it's now come out, Amnesty International did a report not long ago, there was no air attack on demonstrators. Didn't take place.
That was an Al Jazeera report, which certainly was...
Yeah, all made up. I mean, the Russians actually gave a press conference saying, look, we've got satellites and everything. There was no air attack. Now, why did they say that there was an air attack? Because they want to have a no-fly zone. That's why. And it's all in the plan. These rebels, of course, are actually carrying out atrocities. We're now getting evidence coming through that they're actually no better than they ought to be. And they've been working with these groups for years. Islamic Fighting Group, who's the sort of spearhead of this rebellion, they've been working with British intelligence for donkey's years. And they are Al-Qaeda, of course. That shouldn't surprise anybody.
Well, on the subject of Libya, historian and author of George W. Bush, the unauthorised biography, his name is Webster Tarpley, and he's in Libya's capital, Tripoli, this week. He's the presenter of Truth Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett caught up with him there. So this is a couple of minutes of Webster Tarpley from Tripoli this week.
Well, that's a war zone. We're under bombing by NATO, and the NATO planes generally come at night. They're cowards. They kill women and children from 30,000 or 40,000 feet, and they've been attacking various buildings here in the city. Now, for the last couple of days, there have not been large bombing attacks here in the city of Tripoli, but other areas, right, the towns along the coast. Brega and some other places have been bombed. They bombed a food storage facility in Brega, where they had actually some meat lockers were bombed, and a bunch of civilians were killed there. The government here says that the front line is now 50 kilometers east of Ajdabiya, which means that the entire coast, Mediterranean coast of Libya, all the way beyond Ajdabiya, so between Ajdabiya and Benghazi and to some extent towards Tobruk, that's all under government control. And we're also told that there's been a significant victory by the government in the western mountains. Some rebel units have begun to give themselves up, saying that they had been misled. There were a lot of people here who were maybe not so enthusiastic about Gaddafi that have turned in his favor once you see that the alternative to Gaddafi is these NATO air pirates coming in and blowing up your family.
That leads me to ask you, Webster, why in the world would NATO make such a ridiculous miscalculation? I mean, anybody who knows the Arab world knows that if you start bombing like this, it's just going to drive people into the arms of the resistance to the bombing.
This right wing, this Danish fascist Rasmussen, the head of NATO, maybe he can answer that. Let me just say, though, you talked about the revolution. The revolution here is the government. The Arab revolutions, meaning Arab nationalism, Arab socialism, anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, that's pretty much the Gaddafi regime. And it's a In some ways, it's inspired by Nasser in Egypt. There were certainly a lot of exchanges, especially in the early years here after the coup of 1969, between Nasser and the people in the military government and then the Gaddafi regime.
Well, that's Webster Tarpley, author and historian. He's actually out in Tripoli this week talking there. Martin, well, what do you think? He's actually saying that actually the revolution is not the rebels in Libya. The revolution is Gaddafi and the regime in Libya. Is he over egging the pudding there?
I'm not a Libyan. I don't live in Libya. I don't really know what people's opinions are. I don't presume that I can second guess them. I mean, basically, the Libyan people have been pretty well looked after by Gaddafi. Quite clearly, I mean, they started off very poor, and they're basically, you know, they get free healthcare, they get free education, all the rest of it. I still probably wouldn't like to live there. And people have got a right to just change their government if they want, but there's no reason whatsoever for us to stick our finger into it. It's their business and their business only. And of course, our motivation for sticking our finger in is completely wicked. They just want to steal from them, as Elijah was pointing out earlier. And that's not a good reason for a war. You deserve to lose if you're going to take that sort of attitude.
Now, aside from all the morals of whether we should be fighting these wars, Elijah, do you sense that the army is getting overstretched? Because some of the chiefs of the various forces are also saying to the government, well, hang on a minute, you know, we can't keep this up.
Whenever you get a system that wants to use force to go forward and make as many what they call positive gains, Clausewitz, positive advance, you know, the positive aim, then you're going to overstretch your resources as a matter of course. It doesn't matter how big the army gets, it will always be overstretched. That's how you run an operation like that.
And do you think that there is still this sort of illusion of empire? Because Britain used to be a big empire back in the 1910s, 20s, 30s or whatever. And do you sense that the people running things actually still think that?
The British Empire is not even yesterday's news. It was before that. The American Empire is yesterday's news.
Martin, would you agree with that? You think?
Yeah, I think that basically it's the same old, isn't it? If you look at what we're doing with the Americans in tow, or we're in tow with the Americans, it's a 19th century reprise, isn't it? Scramble for Africa, you know. It's sad because we're actually a tiny little speck of dust in the middle of nowhere. And, we actually need to sort out our stuff. You know, the planet requires some healing, and it requires some leadership. And a different kind of leadership in the West had a real opportunity with the collapse of the Soviet Union to do some good stuff. They've chosen, instead, to behave like fascist barbarians. And I'm afraid that's the truth of it. And it's a big shame, and it's an insult to all the people that sacrificed in the two world wars, frankly.
Elijah, you're a former soldier. Do you see any good leadership out there? Or do you think would you agree with Martin that leadership is in crisis?
Well, I agree. But as I said before, you know, it's all quite easy to see. Everything that's going on is simple, it's straightforward, and it's been going on forever. The clue's in the word when you're talking about, is it genuine revolution? Clue's in the word revolution. Goes round again, like a little wheel, back to the place where it started. It's all obvious stuff, gentlemen. But what you need to be doing, really, is if you're going to ask questions about it, is ask what can be done about it to change it at a local level.
Yeah, so let's not be passive.
Okay.
Yeah, let's not be passive, because we've already established that the world's run by gangsters. We only get involved in a fight when it's good for our resource, the gaining of our resources for our tribe. And any old excuse will do. Freedom and democracy sounds like a nice excuse. We use that one again, people like that.
So what solutions do you see, if any?
We need to have a complete rethink. If we look at our big society, we've had it over and over and over again. Who are we going to vote for next time? We've been let down by everybody continually. So, and people have even done the apathetic not voting thing. That's getting to like half the people in the country don't vote. A change is coming. A change has to come. A change has to be forced to come. Yeah. Recently, in our own community, just down in Stokescroft, they said there was a riot. I mean, honestly, I was there. It wasn't such a riot. There was a lot of police battering a lot of people. And people really got annoyed, because that's what you do when people hit you over the head with metal sticks. The police are out of control. The government's out of control. We need something different across the board. It's not just a defence issue. It's a complete governmental issue. This government needs to go, and anyone that you're thinking of replacing it with probably needs to go as well. And we need to have a complete rethink, and then we'll deal with defence under that.
isn't it really only possible to do that on quite a local level? You can't expect that kind of sea change to happen nationally. I mean, although that, of course, the people in Egypt would like to think that it's happened over there, but there's been not a lot of change because the military have kind of taken over in Egypt.
I mean, England, a green and pleasant land, probably be the last place you'll see a revolution. The last time we had one was about 1649, something like that. And that wasn't such a revolution. That was just somebody else deciding they'd have the top jobs, you know.
I think there is going to be a revolution, actually.
I hope so. I'll be there if it happens.
Not just in Britain.
How about an evolution instead?
Well, what we need is a transformation, yeah?
Yeah, an evolution. Revolution's getting boring.
Revolution's a pointless... I mean, it's just a play on words, isn't it? We need a big change. Call it what you will. Yeah. And it will come because the banks are collapsing, the economy's in crisis. We've got to go through this horrible period now, but we've got to have a vision of what we want on the other side. And we've got that vision. We know what we want. We know basically what we're after. And in actual fact, it's not that difficult. But we've even got economists and people who know how to do it. The problem is we've got all the goodwill and they've got all the artillery. And ultimately, this system has to be broken. But it is being broken. It's being broken in the fields of Afghanistan. It's being broken. And eventually it will be broken to bits.
I mean, look at Greece, for example. I mean, isn't it sort of just breaking down all on its own?
The potential there for that to cause a complete banking collapse is absolutely there. Absolutely there.
And only you could go. And then Spain and Portugal, everybody kicking off all over.
It'll all go. I've been trying to get money out of my bank account today, and the Co-op bank seems to be offline for some reason. But we could easily come to a situation where the ATMs just stop. Yeah, it's happened before. Happened in Argentina. And that's good. That can happen. And then what are people going to do? You can't get any money out. Yeah? What are people going to do at that point? I mean, in the US, you've got all of these people with automatic weapons.
Mm.
Yeah? That's a really scary prospect, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So they've got no unemployment benefit, but they have got automatic weapons. Great.
Well, one change that has happened this week, David Cameron's Defence Secretary and local MP Liam Fox has announced big changes to the Senior Decision-Making Board at the Ministry of Defence. It's part of a speedily implemented review, which has been done by Lord Levine and Financial Management at the Defence Board, which this is where a lot of the big decisions, in fact, all the big decisions are made about in Ministry of Defence spending. Decisions have been taken largely out of the hands of the military and put into the hands of the Conservative politicians. Now, let's have a listen to what Liam Fox had to say a couple of days ago in the House of Commons.
The Defence Reform Unit recommends a strengthened decision-making framework for defence centred on a new, leaner defence board based around the Defence Secretary who chairs and makes the decisions. He will be supported by the Permanent Secretary and the Chief of the Defence Staff who will bring to the meeting the views of the single service chiefs. I have already established this new board and chaired the first meeting last week. Allowing the chiefs to spend more time with their service reduces the requirement for commander-in-chief appointments, and these will be phased out as part of a general reduction in senior posts.
Well, allowing the defence chiefs to spend more time with their service. It sounds almost like I want to spend more time with my family. It's one of those almost mealy-mouthed ways of saying, I'm sacking you, or they're resigning. Well, actually, what's happening is they're being elbowed out. This is actually a big rebalancing in the Ministry of Defence, Martin, and what's happening is the defence chiefs are being sidelined and the politicians are taking over a lot of those roles and decisions about spending. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I mean, we need to think what we want the army to be doing, all the services, full stop. I mean, you know, before you spend a load of money, decide what you want.
It seems to be a reaction to quite a lot of the heads of the forces, Army, Navy and Air Force, saying, look, we're getting too overstretched. And it may be a way of just sort of pushing them back slightly from the decision-making process and saying,
it's crisis management, isn't it? It's crisis management. They're supposed to have won in Afghanistan. They're supposed to have won in Libya. They're supposed to have won in Iraq, but they haven't, and they don't know what to do. They're starting to have a bit of a panic, so they're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, aren't they? I had vision for the future of the British Army. It was the sort of things that they were doing in Bosnia. They could be the world's crack peacekeeping force, but not if you've got a reputation as a bully, which we've now got, and that means that there's no role for them as peacekeepers either. And we may have to just disband the whole lot in the end because there's no point having it.
Well, talking about revolutions and cash point machines stopping working, and Argentina back in the early 2000s, where they had complete runaway inflation and many people lost all their savings. This is all quite weird and scary stuff. But let's have a little bit of music to carry us on through that, because there's a positive side to it all. And this one is called Babylon Is Gonna Fall.
Towers made of steel, but that won't connect heaven and the ground. These days, money, not love, is the thing that makes this world go round. We got no more faith in our foundation, and this base ain't strong. Just an illusion, and one day soon, Babylon is gonna fall. Yes, it is. Serving humans will always be indulging our humanity. We've got no more faith in our foundation, and this base ain't strong at all. This world is just an illusion, and one day soon, Babylon is gonna fall.
From New World Sun, the album's just out. It's Salvation Station. Babylon is gonna fall. Now, Monday, this coming Monday, is the 4th of July. That's US Independence Day. But at some American bases in the UK, local people will be celebrating Independence from America Day. Just like the Afghans and Iraqis, the US presence gets on their nerves, and they're fed up, well, not quite just like the Afghans and Iraqis, they're fed up with fenced-off sections of Britain being treated as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier. Earlier this week, I spoke to one of the founder members of the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases, and that's Lindis Percy, up in Harrogate in North Yorkshire, and asked her about her local base, Menwith Hill.
My name's Lindis Percy. I jointly coordinate the Campaign for the Accountability of American Bases. We look into what they're doing in the United States visiting forces in this country, and indeed worldwide. On Monday, people may know or remember that it's July the 4th. For the American people, it's Independence Day. But for us at this American base where the demonstration is, it's Independence from America.
So what is Menwith Hill?
Well, it's an American base under the guise of RAF Menwith Hill. The American authorities, US authorities, occupy and control it, and it's the world's largest intelligence gathering and surveillance base. It is in the wonderful Yorkshire Dales, Nidderdale, and there's a new satellite dish going up, and they look like huge golf balls, and they really sort of hoover up from satellites going around the world information that the Americans tap into and monitor. Communications.
I remember reading about this in Duncan Campbell's books and television programs he did in the 1980s.
Yes.
Is it right that Menwith Hill is so powerful they can actually listen to not only this radio broadcast but also the phone conversation that we're having now?
They can. It's part of the Echelon system. I mean, if anybody wants to find out about it, Google Echelon and they'll find out. They can potentially and do tap into any airborne form of communication. So that's emails, faxes, phone calls. And they do it without the knowledge of the British government. They just do what they want to do, frankly.
There is a sort of intelligence sharing agreement where the Americans spy on the British people and the British spy on the American people. But ultimately, I mean, from the defence point of view, what's wrong with that?
We should be doing our own intelligence, in my view. I mean, yes, I would, you know, we need some sort of intelligence gathering because we do live in a very dangerous world. But the point is that there is very little accountability. I mean, there is the Intelligence Security Committee that ostensibly oversees what goes on at Menwith Hill and other bases. But in fact, you know, they're not allowed to know exactly what goes on there. They're not shown the sort of inner operations of Menwith Hill. And the committee only reports to the Prime Minister, not to Parliament. I mean, they do produce a report now and again, but, I mean, a lot of it's redacted out.
Can you give us a bit of an insight of some of the things that you've found out that have really surprised you about what happens inside Menwith Hill?
Well, I used to go in a lot, and I now have 5 permanent injunctions around American bases. I mean, I have to say that it's, you know, these bases are very insecure. People say, oh, but they, you know, they're here for our defence and our security. Not at all. In our view, American bases put all our security at risk. Campaign for the Accountability of American Bases only puts out information that is well-researched and well-confirmed. And things like, you know, we knew that Menwith Hill was run by the National Security Agency of America, a very secretive organisation, but it was never confirmed. And, you know, we do things like ask parliamentary questions and gradually chip away for information. We were the first campaign in 1997 to find out that Menwith Hill and later Fylingdales, which is also in Yorkshire, were to be designated part of the American missile defense system. You know, this crazy, crazy weapon system, US weapon system in space. It is for their interest and for military interest only. I wonder if people realize, some people may, that warfare is going to be fought in space, in cyber warfare. And missile defense is all part of that. But the point is, Tony, that missile defense is a highly complicated technological system that doesn't work, won't work. It's part of Ronald Reagan's daft idea. Do you remember Star Wars? All over these years, they've tried to develop it. And recently, very recently, 2 weeks ago, we asked one of the MPs, Fabian Hamilton, who asks questions for us, to ask this question about when was this system going to be ready and operational at Menwith Hill. And the answer came back that it's going to be ready, sort of, it is operational now and certainly will be at the end of the year. And it's really, I mean, it's Nick Harvey, Minister of Defence, one of those ministers in the coalition government, really being quite duplicitous about the answer, because it is never going to work. It really isn't. And I'm not, it's not just me saying that. You know, there are very sort of credible academics and military people who are saying that. We found out, you know, confirmation. I mean, this is, CAB was formed in 1992. We've had information confirmed But, you know, yes, it is an American base. It is commanded by the US commander. They are in control and occupation.
So is it fair to say this is a bit of American soil up in North Yorkshire?
Yes, it is. I mean, it isn't. I mean, technically, the land is in the possession of the Secretary of State for Defence. I mean, that's another thing we found out, because there was a legal action that I was involved with in the High Court in 1993. And that was confirmed, and we have some very interesting documents which really sort of tells us how these American bases were given just free rein to do what they like. And it was never debated in Parliament, but they did actually make sure that the land was in the possession of the Secretary of State for Defence. There are no leases on American base. That's another thing we found out. So, you know, they're in firm control. They're dug in.
Particularly with this missile defence, that actually may make people in Yorkshire a target for a nuclear attack, possibly.
Absolutely. I mean, they're quite clever with the names of these systems, aren't they? Clever or deliberate. Missile defence is actually an offensive system. They can attack whoever, whenever they like, once they've got the system in place. I have to say, Tony, that it's cost billions and billions and billions of dollars over the years. And at a time when, you know, the world is in such a state, you know, a lot of poverty in the States, no credible health care for some people, they're spending all this money on this crazy system, and also with all these US bases around the world. Indeed, when you say that these bases put all our security at risk, they do indeed. I mean, Menwith Hill is a very significant, strategically important base for the American military.
Our nearest American base is Fairford, which a few years ago, all of the B-52 bombers, these massive bombers the Americans had based there, actually went off and flew back to the US after having finished with the Iraq War. So is it fair to say the Americans are actually now sort of giving up their bases?
No, Fairford is actually in mothballs. It's a very long runway, if you remember. And it can take, I mean, it's the one that takes B-52s, and in fact, when they were going off to Iraq, the illegal invasion of Iraq, I went to Fairford. I climbed in. I was going home, actually, after a conference, and I climbed in because I turned round, because I heard on the news that 8 B-52s had arrived. I climbed in, and I sat under a B-52 for about 4 hours, and nobody knew I was there. At that time, it was meant to be high on security, but it just is an example of how vulnerable these places are. But as I say, Fairford is now in mothballs, but can be activated whenever.
What is it that drives you to keep going and to try and bring attention to what's going on, particularly at Menwith Hill?
It happens to be Menwith Hill because we live in Harrogate, which is about 8 miles away. So, you know, that's the sort of focus. But CAB isn't just involved with Menwith Hill. We are involved with finding out what the US visiting forces are doing here and trying to bring public scrutiny and awareness to all this. Once you find out about these things, there is very little accountability, hence the name of the campaign. But what drives me, my background was in the health service. I trained as a nurse, then a midwife and health sister. I first came across the whole question of nuclear weapons in the early 80s. I mean, it's quite late, really, when I was a midwife in Southampton, and came across Greenham Common. And we went to this meeting, my husband and I, to find out, come and hear about cruise missiles. So we went, and I was utterly shocked by the fact that these nuclear missiles were coming to a base just up the road, whoever's weapons they were. I thought it was utter madness. And so I sort of had this outrage, really, about the fact that we are just making the world so dangerous. And if people really get into the whole question of, you know, what the Americans are doing around the world and other countries in terms of nuclear weapons or really dangerous weapon systems, then you get tapped into it. It's the sort of thing that I wouldn't give up, Tony, because these things don't go away. They get worse, actually. And it is a sort of, I feel passionate about it, I really do, because, you know, at that time it was, when I was a midwife, it was just coming up to Thatcher days, really. the start of the privatisation of the health service, really. Market forces and consumerism and the purchaser and the provider. And money short in health service, and at that time, you know, massive amount of money spent on weaponry and these cruise missiles coming up the road. And I also found out, when I went to Green and Common, I thought, what are all these American soldiers doing here? I thought, doesn't look as if it's, because it was called RAF Green and Common, doesn't look as if it's RAF at all. So that's how I got into the whole question of the United States visiting forces being in occupation and control of quite a lot of large areas of this country, with very little accountability.
Can you give us an idea of the extent of the American presence in Britain still?
Actually, it's quite difficult to find out, and actually even the Pentagon doesn't know exactly, it's incredible, doesn't exactly know how many bases there are. There are 6,000 bases, probably around 6,000 bases in the States. There are about 1,000 bases worldwide and growing. There are about 12 U.S. bases in this country, so that's Fairford, Mildenhall, Lakenheath, Menwith Hill, Molesworth, Alconbury, Croughton. But it is quite difficult to find out because, you know, what is a military, U.S. military base? I mean, there are quite a lot of bases, RAF bases, you know, British bases, where there is an American presence.
Is it fair to say there's a bit of hostility between the British and the Americans?
If you're thinking about the way some MPs have been denied access to American bases, I mean, the thing is about this, all this, that there's very little questioning about, you know, well, what are they doing? And people say, oh, yes, but they've got to be secret, you know, because, you know, it's an intelligence-gathering place if we're talking about Menwith Hill. But our point is, Tony, that, you know, it must be, they must be accountable to someone, to some credible committee or whatever. Alan Bennett, you know, the writer, also came to Menwith Hill for July the 4th one year, and his point was that, yeah, we should be doing our own dirty work. We shouldn't get other people to do it.
That was Lindis Percy from the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases. Final part of Unlawful Killing, about the death of Diana and NATO secret armies next week. Thanks very much to Doug Naismith and Elijah Smith, and also Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, anniversary of the London bombings, and the government are rolling out plans to criminalise squatting. Thisweek.org.uk, you'll find us on the web. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol